Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to webinar where we will discuss the overview of the education sector, the advent of EdTech, innovative structures for investment and legal, regulatory and tax challenges which have to be kept in mind. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in a listen-only mode and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Vivek Kathpalia. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thank you so much. I hope everyone can hear me clearly. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Not only a global audience we have on the call today, but interestingly enough, we also have a global panel. And I think it's so interesting and exciting that we have people joining from India and from the US and from Europe. I think the sector has generated a lot of excitement. We did a webinar and roundtable in Mumbai last month, and we received an overwhelming response. Of course, from a time zone perspective, it wasn't very convenient for our friends in North America, so we decided to do this again. And so welcome to all of you. Thank you for joining us. We have a global panel in the sense that we have speakers from our offices in India and from our offices in the US, in New York and Palo Alto. I'll quickly introduce the panelists and then we can go straight into the substantive aspect of this webinar. Apart from myself, Vivek Kathpalia, I head the education practice at the firm. I'm based in our office in Singapore and I'm visiting New York. I attended a education conference yesterday, which was very exciting and has given me more food for thought to share with you all today. My colleague, Arushi Jain, who leads the education practice out of our office in Mumbai, she is very hands-on and very knowledgeable in all the regulatory aspects of the education space and from an intellectual property perspective. So she will talk to us a little bit about those aspects. I have my colleague Vaibhav Parikh, who heads our technology and M&A practice at the firm globally. He's currently visiting our offices in Palo Alto. So he will be able to give us a good insight into the technology aspect of investments in EdTech and what he's seeing from a cross-border perspective. Then we have, I have my colleague Mansi Seth, who's in our office in New York. She heads this office and is also practices international tax. And as you know, if you're doing any cross-border transaction in any space, and specifically in a space such as education, tax also becomes an important aspect to know about. So she'll talk about that a little bit. And lastly, but not the least, I have Aishwarya, who is based in our office in Palo Alto. She heads our private equity and M&A practice in the US. She has a lot of experience in doing international transactions across various industries. So I'll ask her a few questions relating to her experience as far as FDI investments into India and you know, what are some of the type of instruments, et cetera, that are typically used. So with that, I'm going to go straight into a bit of the introductory aspect. Why are we doing this webinar and what's changed as far as education is concerned? Now, some of you who have dialed in from India are probably a little bit more familiar with what's happening on the ground. But for our friends in the US and in Europe, you know, obviously we have a rather large population of over 1.2 billion people, and 70% of our population is very young, under the age of 30. And therefore, there is a dire need for employability and skill development. Our education system over a period of time has been quite socialistic and rightfully so, because we have, as a country, so many people, different states, different socioeconomic backgrounds. And therefore, state schools are obviously at a K-12 level predominant in the higher education space. Most of the universities in India are either state-owned or run or under some sort of a regulatory framework from the federal government. We have the sector which is preschool, early child care, early child learning sector, which is more or less unregulated. But then at some state levels, regulatory aspects are creeping in as well. So It's estimated, I think, that in the years to come, the investment in the education sector opportunity is going to go up to about $5 billion. And I think these are numbers which are slightly conservative in my view, but it's always good to be conservative. It's also a key impact investment sector. So we are seeing number of investors, apart from your traditional strategic investors and private equity investors, you're also seeing a lot of impact investment opportunities in the education sector. So very interesting structures of social impact bonds, corporate social responsibility, et cetera. We'll touch about those types of structures in a bit as well. And therefore, we thought this was an opportune moment to talk about what's happening in the education space. I'm going to set the tone by basically giving all of you a background of how the sector is organized in India, and then we'll go into some of the specifics. So basically, if you look at the education sector, education as a legislative aspect comes in what we call the concurrent list of the Indian Constitution, which basically means that you can have federal level legislation as well as state level legislation. So quite similar to what you're used to in the United States, where the federal government can have model rules and laws, and bulk of the legislative work is actually done by the states. So we are fairly similar in that aspect. We have sectors ranging from the preschool sector, the early childcare sector, K-12, higher education, and then of course we have what is called the professional education, edtech, and which basically falls into the unregulated spaces, more technology driven. And in fact, at the conference yesterday in New York, I was amazed to see the amount of innovation that is taking place in the edtech environment, and not only edtech providers, investors in edtech, but also the traditional schools and colleges which are adopting edtech in a massive way. So there is an entire ecosystem developing from a provider perspective, a user perspective, and an investment perspective. And we are seeing that happening in India as well. As you all know, India is fairly technology savvy. We have a very large services industry, and therefore anything to do with technology comes quite naturally to us. And edtech is just one of the facets of that these days. Most of the education sectors are obviously regulated, similar to what you have in Europe and the US. So your K-12 in India and the higher education sector predominantly is heavily regulated. You have state-level regulations and you have federal-level regulations. So from an investment perspective and from a strategic perspective, if you're going to invest in the sector, you need to know what the regulatory framework really is. And quite different from some countries, most of it is not for profit. And therefore, if you look at K-12 and higher education in India, it has to be structured in a not-for-profit kind of manner. And therefore, the questions really come up, is it a sector that you can really invest in, and can you really make a profit in K-12 and higher education? We'll touch upon those aspects in a bit as well. The preschool sector is fairly unregulated. It's not mandatory to have a not-for-profit structure, except one or two states in the country where they're trying to get the preschool sector also under the not-for-profit umbrella. And therefore, we've seen a large interest from both domestic and foreign investors and from strategic players globally in partnering, investing in the preschool sector in the country. With a population of 1.2 billion people and a fast-growing population, there is a huge opportunity in the preschool and early child care and early child learning sector in India. So that's a very exciting, unregulated space where a lot of activity is currently taking place. At the federal level, we have affirmative action as far as K-12 is concerned. So there is a constitutional obligation under the Right to Education Act in India to reserve certain number of seats for primary education. And this again goes back to the philosophy of having a social net. How this impacts schools is important to understand, because if you're a K-12 operator in India, or if you're an investor in K-12, and we did a transaction recently where a foreign private equity fund has invested in the K-12 sector, you have to have 25% of your seats reserved for the economically backward sector in India. And this applies to all schools. So you may be a private school, you may be a school which has a very high fee, you may be a school which reaches out to a very elite demography, but at the same time, you have to have affirmative action in the schools. Now, in practice, obviously, whether students from the economically backward section will apply to certain schools is a different aspect. But from a cash flow perspective, from a projections perspective, you need to, the schools have to keep that in mind. And therefore, when we do due diligence on schools for investors, the Right to Education Act and its applicability and the fact that it could have impact on cash flows going forward, and how the school therefore restructures itself to ensure that it doesn't have a large impact becomes very important. The Right to Education Act applies to all K-12 schools, but it doesn't apply to schools which are set up by minorities. And again, in India, we have, as you know, culturally a diverse religious and social framework. So if you're a minority institution, which basically means that you've been recognized by the government as a recognized minority, and you're running an institution as a minority institution, then the Supreme Court of India has said that since the minorities also have specific rights under the Constitution, the Right to Education Act will not apply to K-12 institutions run by minorities. And therefore, from an investment perspective, does that therefore make more sense to try and see whether you can do a transaction with a school which is in the minority sector? And minorities are not only religious minorities, but also linguistic minorities. So therefore, that becomes another kind of consideration when we are seeing clients look at the K-12 sector in India. It's also important to understand that whilst it may be not-for-profit, 100% foreign direct investment is permitted in education. So it's a bit of a paradox, actually, because if you look at many countries, they are very conservative as far as foreign investment in education, and rightfully so. They want to protect the education sector in the country for various socio-political reasons. But India has permitted 100% foreign direct investment in education for many, many years. The reason it really didn't kick off to a large extent was obviously the fact that it had to be structured in a not-for-profit manner, so you would have to have a trust or a society, and therefore the ability to extract revenue became difficult. So the structures that have developed over a period of time have been structures which are what we call the management company and the service company structure, where from a K-12 investment perspective, you can actually invest in a corporate, in a company which provides various services to the not-for-profit entity which actually runs the schools. And there are, this has become pretty much standard practice as far as the education sector in India and K-12 is concerned. And therefore, whilst it's past regulatory muster, you need to be careful that it is not seen that a not-for-profit activity is stripping away all the revenue that is earned by the trust of the society which runs the school. So intricate structuring and documentation is required when you do those deals. In the higher education space for colleges and universities, currently there is no scope for foreign institutions to actually set up campuses in India. The University Grants Commission, which is the regulator for higher education in India for non-technical education, and the All India Council for Technical Education, which regulates technical education, do have rules which permit collaborations. My colleague Arushi will touch upon that a little bit later. And therefore, we are seeing a growth in collaborations between universities in the United States primarily and in India, joint degrees, diplomas, students being able to do part of the study in India, do part of the study in the US. We are seeing offline and online models evolving, blended models evolving. And therefore, from a regulatory perspective, a lot of the work that we end up doing is ensuring that these collaboration contracts and agreements are meet the regulatory tests, and obviously even from a tax perspective, which Mansi will talk about, from paying royalties or services, and how does that impact the tax base. So I think that's kind of a brief background of the general kind of sense that we see in the education sector. There has also been recently, as far as the K-12 sector is concerned, a further tightening of fee regulation environment. And as I said, it's fairly controlled. So some states have come up with laws which basically put some sort of control that the government has on the kind of fees that schools are charging. So these are not government schools or state schools. These are private unaided schools. And therefore, there is a battle going on currently in the courts in India as to whether the governments can actually interfere in the fee setting process of private unaided schools. It's important to understand the distinction between aided and unaided. Unaided basically means that you receive no aid from the government. You don't get concessions on land. You don't get any tax concessions. And therefore, you're a self-funded school. As far as the aided schools are concerned, obviously they depend on the government for infrastructure and incentives, and therefore they have the ability to control the manner in which those schools are run. But as far as unaided schools are concerned, that is not the case. And with these new laws on fee regulation coming in various states very recently across the country, there is a fight going on in the courts as to whether the government has the right to interfere. And we'll see how that pans out. But that, again, is very critical from a investment perspective, because if you're an investor in a K-12 school, not only do you have to have the affirmative action part looked at, but you also have to understand what the fee regulation legislation could have an impact on the cash flows. We've spoken to a number of our clients in this space, and they feel that the impact will not be as much as one believes it to be, because there is an ability to increase the fees up to 15%. So I won't go into the technical details of that, but just to give you a broad understanding of what's going on in the space. From a structural perspective, if you look at some of the deals that are happening recently, and we talked about some of these innovative structures, we have seen, apart from your traditional investment in a corporate structure or a franchise arrangement or some sort of a collaboration, we've also seen some hybrid instruments that have been used in doing deals in the education space in India, and non-convertible debentures. We did one transaction recently where three marquee private equity funds in fact did a listed bond investment into a large education chain in India. This is public information, and it was a first of its kind transaction where it was a pure debt transaction, cross-border. The investors invested from their vehicles in Singapore into a very well-known and large education chain in the country. The education chain, through its services entity, which I spoke about recently as the common structure in K-12, was able to issue listed bonds to these foreign investors. And the interesting aspect of this type of instrument is that, it's fully secured. It has obviously education has predictable cash flow, so you know exactly what the cash flow of the education institution is going to be. And you have the ability to, the education institution has the ability to use those funds, even though it's foreign debt, with no end use restrictions. Because otherwise, in India, if you borrow money from overseas, you have to be able to borrow that money under the law and as an eligible borrower. And secondly, if you can, there are a number of restrictions on what you can do with that money. So this was a first of its kind transaction, happened last year. And we've seen a lot of interest amongst the international investors as well as schools and universities in India as to how this NCD structure could be used by them. We've seen a lot of monetization of real estate by the universities and schools in India by selling their real estate to real estate funds or non-banking financial companies, what is now become commonly known as a sale and leaseback structure, where there is a lot of real estate infrastructure which is sitting with these schools. They are unable to monetize it, and therefore they sell it and they lease it back. And that has created another opportunity, not only for these funds who can then potentially roll these assets up into some sort of a REIT structure, but also for the schools and colleges who are able to monetize and get capital by selling this real estate and use that money for expansion and other modernization of their infrastructure. So that's another type of transactions that we have seen. So if you look at these type of debt instruments and equity instruments, there are always some tax implications that one needs to also keep in mind. So as a law firm, we have a holistic kind of approach to doing these deals. Whilst we look at the legal and regulatory aspects of education, we also need to marry the tax aspects into it. And Mansi, when our clients are doing deals like this, right, if you're looking at a listed bond, for example, versus doing just a plain vanilla equity investment in a services company or a management company, what are some of the tax considerations or possibly advantages that one has over the other?
Sure. Thanks, Vivek. So I think when you're looking at investing in the services company structure, of course, there are broadly speaking, you could either invest in equity or you could look at the NCD structure that Vivek was talking about. In terms of the tax exposure that you have, now India is not a low tax jurisdiction. We still have like about a 30% corporate tax rate. When you're making investment in equity of a company, you do need to be mindful that at any point of time when you're trying to repatriate profits, there's an additional 20% tax that could apply. Of course, if you're looking at exits and not continuous payouts, then you need to make sure that while you're making these equity investments, you're investing from the right treaty jurisdiction. Before I get into the advantages of NCD, maybe I'll spend a little bit of time on that. For example, for investors that are investing from the U.S., if you were to directly make investments into the equity of a company from the U.S., and at exit, when you apply the India-U.S. tax treaty, it is very clear that the capital gains tax could apply in both jurisdictions. And just the way the two countries have their sourcing rules, and I'm not going to get into much detail on that, but just the way the tax laws of the two countries work, you could land up in a situation where you end up paying capital gains tax both in India as well in the U.S. And that is maybe a 10% or a 20% hit in India and maybe a 30-odd% in the U.S. So given that complication, it is important to make sure that when you're looking at these equity investments, you structure them right. We could explore some of the treaty jurisdictions which might have a better treaty with India as opposed to the U.S., and we have looked at structures like that in the past for these investments. Another aspect when we're looking at these structures important is the bilateral investment treaty, which is the other thing that the India-U.S. don't have, but for example, India-Mauritius have that. And that could be another reason why we look at these alternate jurisdictions from where you could be making these equity investments. When we move to debt investments, the biggest advantage that one has is the deduction of the interest and the lower withholding on that interest payout as compared to the dividend distribution tax that is payable on equity, which is almost 20%. Now, it is when I'm talking about the dividend distribution, I want to make a small mention of another entity which has in the last few months being used for in other sectors, and now actually for one of the clients, we've also tried to use it in the education space, which is the limited liability partnership. Now, that also helps in mitigating this dividend distribution tax. There is the one-level corporate tax, which is applicable to a company. That applies to an LLP as well. But this additional 20% is not applicable to limited liability partnership. And the reason why it's become popular in the last few months is because this route was only recently liberalized and foreign investment was allowed in the under the automatic route. So because of that, that is something some of the clients are looking at. However, there you have some other regulatory or practical limitations. For example, whether you can list, in terms of list, when you want to go in for listing, an LLP structure may not work and you may have to look at converting to a company structure. Or, for example, this NCD route where the bonds need to be listed, that may not work for an LLP. So that is something that, depending on the client structure, we look at. Now, coming last to the NCD structure, which is an excellent structure from a tax perspective, because as you pay these interest payments, you will get a deduction for the Indian entity, and at the same time, your withholding rates, again, depending on the treaty or the jurisdiction where you're investing from, could be lower. If you make a direct investment from a non-treaty jurisdiction, yes, you could have a higher withholding. Some cases, it even goes up to 40%. But when you're doing a treaty jurisdictions, and particularly when you're doing these listed bonds, domestically, there's a 5% rate that is applicable, which is a very beneficial rate compared to our income interest withholding rates that apply on the other streams of income. So in that sense, I think Vivek, an NCD is a great structure, tax efficient, and I think it works from a tax perspective.
Thanks so much, Mansi. So I think we'll see more of those structures for investment, not only in education and other sectors as well. Very quickly, before I go to Arushi, who's in our office in Mumbai, and I'm going to ask her some questions relating to higher education, and that's going to be of key interest to our U.S. friends and European friends who want to do collaborations in India. I would just like to spend a minute on another instrument that has become interesting and more from a social impact perspective. We are now seeing development impact bonds, social impact bonds, as well as the outcome payer model in the education sector. This is obviously more from a not from so much from a financial return perspective, though it does have a aspect of financial return. It's also from the perspective of doing some social good. Obviously, if you work in the education sector in India, you can't ignore this sector. So there has been a bond that has been issued recently, which is called the Educate Girls Bond, a very successful kind of structure where UBS has basically subscribed, investors of UBS have subscribed to these bonds. The money has gone to a non-government organization in the state of Rajasthan in India. There are outcomes which have been set. So outcomes relating to the number of girls that come to school, the number of girls that progress to classes, and if you meet each of these various outcomes, and there is a third-party agency which actually does the measurements, sets the criteria, then there is an outcome payer, which in this case is the Children's Fund, which then pays the subscribers of the bond some return. So I think from a corporate social responsibility perspective, from a social impact perspective, this is going to be an area where instead of just doing plain philanthropy and charitable donation, which is important, we'll see the emergence of these types of bonds. And from a legal perspective and tax perspective, obviously, it becomes important to ensure that they're structured properly so that they have the highest efficacy as far as making an impact. We are seeing low-cost private schools in India. Recently, we have seen that a number of state governments, Andhra Pradesh and other governments, have actually handed over state primary schools, which they are unable to run for lack of funds and infrastructure, to private low-cost school providers, even international providers, who will come in, adopt all these schools. These schools are schools that are, the kind of families that would send their kids to these schools are families that earn less than $2 a day. It makes a lot of sense for the government to tie up with these private players who come in, reputed private players who come in, adopt these schools. We have seen a outcome where the poorest of the poor are willing to pay even $1 or $5 a month to ensure that their children get a proper education versus sending them to a free government school where the government is unable to provide good teachers and technology and training and stuff like that. So this is another area where, from a social impact perspective, there are a number of reputed international players who are partnering with the government in the low-cost private school sector.
Vivek?
Yes?
Vaibhav, I can just add a couple of lines here.
Absolutely.
We are working very closely with India Impact Council, which is working with government on creating the system of social impact bond, which are going to be used in various sectors in education, medical, and some of the other sectors. And as Vivek mentioned, this framework will be has been very widely used in UK and some of the European countries. We are trying to modify it for our Indian needs so we can actually try to get outcomes, which Vivek mentioned, which may be funded by, either some philanthropist office or government or some other people who can give return to the investor who is taking up this particular challenge. So this is something which we're going to see a lot of new developments in next year or so on this particular line.
Yeah, thanks, Vaibhav. That was very, very insightful. I know you've been working closely with IIC. So thanks for that that input. I think we'll, in the interest of time, what I'll do now is I will take the next topic, which is higher education, and Arushi, who's my colleague based in Mumbai. So Arushi, can you tell us what's happening generally in the higher education space in the country, and what are you seeing as far as these various collaborations, the regulatory framework that's developing? But I think that will be of great interest to our overseas friends.
Sure, Vivek. Like you mentioned, higher education is actually a very interesting space for foreign players, because India has a large youth population, but barring a few quality institutions like IITs and IIMs, there is an issue as far as infrastructure, curriculum-based learning is concerned, as well as teachers. This opens brilliant opportunities for foreign players who can provide skill-based education in India. So let's basically discuss where does the opportunity really lie. Now, when we talk about higher education, it can basically be divided into two broad segments. One is the regulated space and other is the unregulated space. Under the regulated space, we cover diplomas, degrees, postgraduate courses, doctoral programs, etc. The regulators primarily being the UGC and the AICTE, which Vivek discussed earlier in the session, which covers technical and non-technical courses. Basically, what this means is that if there are any institutions which are required to be set up in India, which are going to award any degree or diploma kind of courses, permissions from the regulators are required. There are certain norms that are needed to be fulfilled as well. As far as unregulated sector is concerned, that covers certification courses which do not lead to the award of any degree or diploma, vocational or skill-based courses, tutoring classes, coaching programs, and online education or edtech courses, which we will discuss subsequently in the session. Unregulated sector, you know, that like the name suggests, there are no specific regulatory concerns here, and that's why the sector is open for investments as well as for activity. From a foreign education institution's perspective or from a foreign player's perspective, when we look at the regulated sector, collaboration and twinning arrangements are gaining popularity. What this basically means is that an Indian and a foreign education institutions join hands to provide a degree or a diploma kind of a program. The student, spends part of the course program in India, and part of the study is completed at the foreign campus. At the end of the program, a degree is awarded by an Indian institution. Now, both the UGC as well as the AICTE have their own set of regulations as far as collaboration arrangements are concerned. In fact, the UGC very recently, in July 2016, revamped its regulations to allow e-application processes. It has even specified the format of degrees that are supposed to be awarded. Now, given the lacunas that I spoke of earlier, we have seen a lot of activity that is happening in the collaboration space, because foreign players can actually join hands and have their presence felt in India, particularly so because currently, as per the regime in India, foreign educational institutions cannot set up an independent campus. So the only way they can provide a regulated course is by partnering with an Indian institution. Now, as far as unregulated sector is concerned, there's a lot of activity there as well. EdTech definitely is booming, but other than that, there are MOOCs, which are massive open online courses, which are gaining popularity. In fact, the Indian government itself has launched a program which is called SWAM. It's an indigenous platform to offer these certification programs. So that's basically what's really happening in the higher education segment as of now. There are talks time and again about allowing foreign education institutions to set up a campus in India. Way back in 2010, there was a proposal, there was a bill that was formulated to allow setting up campuses. That unfortunately did not go through. There are talks once again. We have also heard news about allowing foreign education institutions to set up in a special economic zone, so that it's easier for them to carry out their activities. But, time will tell what the future really is.
Thanks so much, Arushi. So you talked about the general lay of the land, and you also spoke about the fact that, these collaborations and twinning arrangements are gaining popularity. What about foreign degrees? So if I'm doing a collaboration, if I'm a Harvard or a Yale or any other higher education institution, I have a collaboration with someone in India, an IIT, IIM, or any other university or college. The students are going to be, you know, possibly doing part of the course in India, part of the course overseas. Are these foreign degrees recognized in India? Is it going to be helpful for these students?
Sure. So as far as recognition of foreign degrees is concerned, a body called the Association of Indian Universities, AIU for short, is the principal body, the principal regulator, which recognizes and grants equivalence. Now, when we talk about collaboration arrangements, as far as UGC is concerned, they have clarified that for non-technical kind of courses, the degree that is to be awarded has to be awarded by an Indian education institution. Joint degrees are currently not permitted. However, there can be references to a foreign education institution, you know, also collaborating. There are, you know, no specific restrictions if the degree is awarded from outside India. Now, with respect to, when an institution is set up completely outside India or it's an online model where a student subscribes to a particular course and a degree and diploma course, a degree or diploma is awarded from outside India, currently the way the regulations are structured, they contemplate that degrees are recognized if a student attends a campus like a regular program, actually, you know, goes to the campus, undertakes the program. Online kind of courses are not, the degrees that are awarded in online courses are currently, not recognized. But from a practical perspective, these degrees, they do not make a distinction usually whether, on the certification or when the degree is issued. There's usually no distinction on whether it was completed, whether it was issued when the program was completed while on campus or by way of an online kind of a program. So therefore, from a student perspective, as long as they know that it is a degree which is awarded by a foreign institution, which is of relevance, it should be fine. It really matters when you're trying to apply for a government job or where you're trying to apply, you know, for further studies where equivalence matters. But most of the private players and the companies today recognize the value of skill-based learning. So to that extent, you know, these degrees are helpful for students.
Okay, and I have one more question for you before we go into EdTech and some other aspects. I wanted to check with you, how are these collaborations, how are they happening? In the sense, what are the type of, arrangements that you're seeing, the type of advice that you're giving clients, how are these contracts structured? If you could just shed some light on that.
Sure. So there are a couple of models that we typically work around with. So one is a complete, offshore kind of a model where the entity is set up outside India and they're directly providing education programs to students in India. So it can be by way of online portals, it can be by way of web-based applications itself. Here the students make a payment to these foreign institutions or foreign entities by way of, e-commerce or by way of credit cards and net banking, etc. The second model, which is a variation to this model, is where though the entity is set up outside India and providing education from outside India, they may have some services sort of an arrangement where they may engage a local entity to provide marketing, distribution, or on-ground kind of support services. The third model is a pure license arrangement where the foreign entity gives a license to an Indian institution. This license could be of its brand name, it could be of the curriculum, etc. This is a kind of a win-win situation for all because it enables the foreign institution to have its presence felt in India and provide this curriculum in India. The Indian institution benefits out of the license that it has that it has obtained, and the student benefits because the student can actually go and complete the course in India, but at the same time benefit from the curriculum of the foreign institution. And the other variation to this particular model is a license plus services kind of a structure where not only does the foreign institution provide a license of the brand name, curriculum, know-how, etc., but it also ends up providing certain services, for example, training, recruitment, etc. So these are a couple of models that we have seen in the recent past, which are also gaining popularity from an Indian market scenario.
Thanks, Arushi, for that. That was very helpful. And maybe, Mansi, I can ask you, so the type of collaborations that Arushi spoke about that are happening, for a foreign collaborator and for the Indian collaborator, what are there any tax issues, anything that needs to be seen in these contracts?
Yes, absolutely. So I think...
Participants, please stay connected. We seem to have lost the line. Pamanji.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, while we are waiting, if Arushi is there, maybe she can continue on her higher education experience, which she has done on some of the transactions. Till we wait for them to join.
I believe, do we have, sure, Webber, but do we have Vivek and Mansi on the line yet? Okay. So, in the interest of time, I was thinking that we will probably move on to the EdTech space, Webhav, and I think Vivek and Mansi are back on the line. Mansi, are you there?
We are back on the line. Are we live with the audience now?
Yes, you are. So Mansi, maybe you can start from where the line dropped.
Right,
okay.
Right. So sorry about that. Let me firstly apologize. I think in our excitement, on tax, the phone line got disconnected. So I'm going to now ask Mansi to continue, but very quickly.
So very quickly, whenever there are such arrangements, so other than the investment side, when you're looking at collaborations, it's important to make sure that the foreign entity is not taxed more than what it should be in the Indian entity. Some exposure does arise because of such collaborations. Essentially, what you need to make sure is that the payments that are being made, like Arushi was mentioning, there could be training services or other services, and there's always a licensing arrangement. The payments that are made for these could be categorized as royalty or fees for technical services. Both of those have a tax impact in India, and there could be a withholding that is applicable on the payments that are made. Again, these payments, the treaties are usually more narrowly worded, so it is possible to get out of sometimes being treated as fees for technical services, and which is good because in that case, you don't have a withholding implication in India. So any payments that are being made, it's important to characterize them. If they're not considered royalty, fees for technical services, usually business income, in which case we try to assess whether there's anything that the Indian operations are doing which increases the permanent establishment risk for the foreign entity, which is basically means that if there is a permanent establishment, there could be almost 40% tax in India. So therefore, it's important to mitigate all of that. And I think in brief, those are the things you need to think about.
Thanks a lot, Mansi. So I think collaborations are the talk of the town, but you need to ensure that you have proper advice as far as your contracts are concerned, as well as the tax structures are concerned. So I think we'll now quickly jump into EdTech, and I think that is a lot of you may be waiting for that discussion. because we are now moving from all the regulated stuff to what I call the white space of the unregulated world, and which is obviously the part of any sector where most people like to participate in. So EdTech, as you all know, obviously is the use of technology in education. We have many different types of models developing globally. The US is obviously a pathbreaker as far as the EdTech environment is concerned, and India is quickly learning and adopting a lot of those kind of models. We are seeing the more traditional EdTech, and yes, we have now a distinction between traditional EdTech and non-traditional EdTech, but traditional EdTech, which is your online use of the internet to provide courses such as, you know, what Coursera does, Udacity, they're doing extremely well in India, by the way. It's simple logic because of the population and the number of people that therefore can get these nano degrees. So the buzzword these days is obviously MOOCs and nano degrees, and I think that's really going to be the future. We have clients who are very active in the gamification space, in augmented reality, and making it more exciting and interesting for the kids to actually learn through these models, which could be apps which are downloaded or through digital classrooms. And from a, if you look at the geography of India, and internet penetration, which is still, you know, not as much as it should be, but it's growing very, very rapidly. We have about 700 to 800 million cell phone subscribers in the country. We have access to data becoming cheaper by the day. And therefore, EdTech as a service, as well as EdTech for the schools and colleges to adopt, is becoming a very, very interesting space. So since it's generally technology, I thought I'll ask a question to Vaibhav, who heads our technology practice and is currently in Palo Alto. Vaibhav, you've seen a lot of, and you've done a lot of transactions in the technology space. From a, what's the level of interest you're seeing from the investment you know, community in this particular sector from a cross-border perspective?
Yeah, thank you, Vivek. As Vivek mentioned, number of people in India itself makes it a very lucrative market. On top of it, the culture in India is that they don't consider education as an expense. They consider it as an investment. So even in times when recession is going on, people make sure that they go and not cut corners on education for their kids or for other people. So it's a recession-proof industry in some ways. So obviously, when you have a huge market and a growing affordability with something which can be recession-proof, it will excite a lot of venture capitalists and private equity. And this is exactly what we saw last couple of years. Till about last year, the excitement was very high. In the last 12 months, we have seen the excitement kind of go down. Primarily because while there are a few companies who have actually made mark, and you know, Vivek already mentioned some of the international companies, even Indian companies like Byju's and VidyaNext and some of the other ones are growing pretty well. Most companies have not really picked up the traction which they were expecting to. So as a result, some of the fundings have kind of dried down. And this is also mirroring the other industries also. So it can be a general trend, but also a little bit waiting for education EdTech market to grow up before the investment restarts. Having said that, what we are seeing is that if there are specific situations, then they are still getting funding, mainly in this sector. First sector is where we are looking at technologies which allow distribution in a very innovative way. So that is where we are seeing investments coming in, because the way they are looking at it, that if you are able to develop technologies which will allow to distribute the education and connect people both in urban areas and rural areas, and that's where we feel that investments are still coming in, and that's something which will continue because by the time the technologies get developed, the market may be back and it may be a very good value for the investors. Again, what we are seeing is pure content company has really not picked up in India. So we really don't see too much funding on pure content companies. Those companies like Byju's and some of those companies which provide actual learning experience, which supplements the education for school kids, are growing, and that's where we are still seeing some attraction. again, at all age levels, we have seen companies who get funded focusing on preschool and toddlers and saying, how do I play a game which will teach engineering skills to someone who is, you know, maybe 5 years or 6 years or 10 years, and they can start learning from that age. Secondly, they talk about Skill India. Skill India is a major initiative for Indian government. There is a lot of people, even at the adult level, who needs to be reskilled. And so that is another area where VCs are looking at it. If you are coming with an innovative way of skilling those people who are actually working and who can get new skill and who can be deployed in the industry, then that is another attractive sector which people are trying to find. Again, we have not seen too many investments in this year, but I expect that in future, this will be another big market for startups who are going to focus on a Skill India program. Another area which we are doing is your marketplace. Companies like VidyaNext and others, they are trying to get the students and the tutors put together, and again, helping them on the delivery side. And the delivery technologies, as I mentioned, will become critical for any company's success. Lastly, what I would want to say is the new investments are also going in what Vivek mentioned, the AR and the VR space. There are a lot of entrepreneurs, at least when I see in Bangalore, who are excited to use these particular technologies in education space, and how they can increase the number of or number of minutes or hours which a student puts for learning from what is currently a smaller portion to a larger portion. And the whole game is trying to see how they can spend more and more time and make it more interactive. So gamification is one, but AR and VR is another exciting technologies which people are looking at for the educational use. And of course, using some kind of IoT technologies in trying to make a learning a continuous experience, giving feedback to the parents or teachers, and making it a complete interactive learning experience. So companies which focus on those technologies are getting funded. So that's what I have seen in the last couple of years, Vivek.
That's very, very insightful, Vaibhav. I think your perspective on the fact that technology that helps in distribution and actually provides a system to deliver education is where we'll see a lot of activity. Pure content may not really get that much interest from the investor community. And I think the future does look bright from what you have just pointed out. And maybe I can ask Aishwarya, who's also in Palo Alto. Aishwarya, you do a lot of M&A and private equity. To further to what Vaibhav very succinctly described as far as where he's seeing the technology and which are the sectors of EdTech which are likely to get investment, what are your perspectives as far as the investors, let's say, in the Valley are concerned? If you were to tell them about EdTech in India, how would they go about doing these deals and investments? Just your general experience.
Sure. There's certainly a huge amount of excitement in the Valley as far as the EdTech space in India is concerned. And I think, a large part of it is just a function of the population in India and the kind of, the market that exists for this. The fact that it's a young population, all of the demographic stuff that Arishi covered. In terms of how they are doing these deals, I think if you at a very, very broad level, we're seeing three types of instruments. One is, of course, your equity, and you know that includes compulsorily convertible preference shares as well. You know, which I just kind of put into the equity bucket. All of us know what equity shares are, so I'm not going to cover that. But you know, the of course, equity means that you have the upside. But you know, the one thing to note with equity is that you can only distribute dividends out of profits of the company, so that does become challenging when the company, at least in the initial stages of the company, or when there aren't enough profits to distribute. The interesting structure that has developed, aside from the listed bonds and, you know, social impact bonds, which I'll come to in a bit, is, you know, the compulsory convertible debenture structure, which we call CCDs. Interestingly, while this is a debenture, it is treated as equity from a foreign investment perspective and therefore not subject to the onerous requirements that apply to external commercial borrowings or what we call foreign debt. So from a foreign investment perspective, it is treated as equity, although it does need to be converted at a certain point, and typically we advise that that time frame be about 10 years. You know, just to be on the safe side. So what this instrument does is, very interestingly, allows you to repatriate even when the company does not have profits. So it allows you to repatriate through cash flows as interest. And as Mansi was mentioning, that is deductible. So it is a pretty attractive instrument. There is also a hybrid instrument that is developing in the form of stapled stock, and I think that is a fallout of, you know, the Mauritius Treaty Amendment that just happened. It's something that people were considering previously as well, but I think the amendment to the Mauritius Treaty has now given that impetus in that, you know, you do a combination of debt, compulsory convertible debt, and you do equity as well. And, you know, you kind of use differential voting rights, et cetera, to ensure that you have voting rights through the equity that you own, even though it is nominal. The other instruments, of course, are your listed bonds and social impact bonds, which we have seen now developing. And, you know, that, of course, requires a listing on the stock exchange, et cetera. It's certainly not as onerous as listing a company on the stock exchange. It's a pretty easy process to go through and is a very interesting structure for all of the reasons that were discussed earlier.
Thanks a lot, Aishwarya. I think that was extremely helpful. So I think the good takeaway, at least from what both of you have said, is that the sector is very interesting, and there are instruments, hybrid instruments, traditional instruments that one can use to actually tap into the sector. So therefore, I think structuring deals in the edtech space is very important from a repatriation perspective and a cash flow perspective. Arushi, whilst we are on edtech and we are coming towards the end of the webinar, I also wanted to ask you a couple of questions, actually. On we've looked at tax, we've looked at the sectors in edtech which are interesting, the technologies. Aishwarya's told us about the instruments. From an intellectual property perspective or a data privacy perspective, what are some of the other things that one needs to keep in mind, and what have you seen in the work that you've been doing in this space?
Right. So when we talk about edtech, we've been speaking about how the sector is unregulated. Now, when we say that, it doesn't really mean that there are no laws, but it actually means that there are various laws that could apply depending on the business model. So intellectual property is a principal asset for any edtech enterprise, copyright being the king of it all. So when we speak about copyright, we talk about, you know, the original literary work. So, for example, the question papers, the written content, etc. We talk about the performances. We talk about the background scores, maybe musical notations, etc., which are used from the perspective of, you know, imparting the education. This is all covered under the copyright law in India. Even computer programs are covered within the scope of the Indian Copyright Act. In India, a copyright need not be mandatorily registered. It comes into existence the moment it is created, as long as it's original and creative in nature. So that's really the principal asset for any edtech enterprise. we talk about, then we can talk about, you know, the trademark laws. So trademarks basically give protection to your brand names. So your logos, the branding with which you go out in the market is protected under the Indian Trademark Act of 1999. Registration of trademarks in India is not a mandatory requirement, but it gives you statutory protection, and it's a prima facie proof of validity as far as the mark is concerned. Even if the mark is not registered, there are common law protections which are available. A trademark has to be renewed on a time-to-time basis. The other interesting aspect of trademark is that it's territorial in nature. That means you have to actually apply for a trademark and register it in each jurisdiction where you are either using the brand or intend to use the brand in future. Domain names are treated on similar footing as far as trademarks are concerned, that is under the trademark law. So, in addition to having a .com, it's also, sometimes important to have maybe a .in or a .us if you are trying to go global. Patents come into picture if, there is an invention or of a product or a process which is completely novel or innovative in nature. There are trade secrets and know-how. Every business actually has know-how and trade secrets. In certain countries, they are protected under a statutory regime. In India, there are no specific laws as far as trademarks, trade secrets, and know-how is concerned, but that's protected contractually. The other laws that we look at are the data protection compliances, which are covered under the Information Technology Act in India and the rules which are issued thereunder. So the data protection compliances relates to personal information and sensitive personal data or information, which covers passwords, biometric information, even financial information such as bank account, credit cards. So when you're transacting, say, with an edtech enterprise, it's possible that, some of your personal data or your sensitive information and data is getting collected by them. That's where the compliance requirements really trigger in under the law. And at times in a cross-border scenario, it's possible that, it's not only the Indian law requirements, but even the foreign law requirements where the data is actually collected may come into place. Then there are payment systems. Now, the transactions that happen in an EdTech kind of a scenario are typically e-commerce-based transactions. So this gives rise to various instruments. There are credit cards, net banking, mobile wallets. All these are regulated in India under the Payment and Settlement Systems Act. So depending on the kind of model and the kind of collections that are happening, this could also really come into the play. In addition to that, whether a particular model qualifies to be a regulated or an unregulated model has to be seen. So we end up in our experience when a client comes to us and describes the model, we actually undertake a study to see is there anything in the model that could be regulated and any specific education-related laws that may apply. So for instance, there are certain requirements and certain compliances for distance education, which could even be construed to be provided through an online kind of model. So we evaluate all of these as well.
Thanks, Arush. I think that's very important aspect that you pointed out on distance education, because distance education has been mode of reaching out to a number of people in the country for a lot of years, but has always been structured in a more traditional manner. And I think one of the questions that a lot of our online and MOOC providers, both domestically and internationally, ask us is whether the existing distance education laws and rules, how would they apply to the technologies which are so far advanced today? And as we always see that technology is so far ahead of the law and regulation, so that also requires us to be able to interpret those different types of legislations, regulations. I think we have covered a lot of, we could go on for hours actually, but I think we've got a good perspective on the education framework, the investment framework, what we are seeing from a cross-border deal perspective. I think we can ideally end here and go to some questions. I'm sure and I hope that the audience has some questions for us. If the operator could take us to any questions that might be there.
Sure, thank you very much. We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to only use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one at this time. Right, we have the first question from the line of Bettina Wolf of Bertelsmann. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello to everyone. I just had a question whether I got it right. Having heard your presentation, is it right that if one wants to provide online e-learning services in India, I could either set this up as a foreigner by myself 100% or I could acquire an existing company? Again, no foreign investment restrictions in that regard?
Right. So, Bettina, Vivek here. Let me try and answer that question for you. Yes. So I think the answer to the question is you can either set it up yourself, 100% foreign direct investment, an online e-learning platform, as long as it is not providing degrees in India, and it's more from a certification or a unregulated online e-learning program. You could own it 100%. Or you could even acquire a existing entity. Just to give you an example, we recently did a transaction, and I can talk about this because it's already in the public domain. DeVry Education Group, which is a large for-profit education group in the United States, has acquired a majority a stake in an Indian company, which, amongst other things, also provides online e-learning. So the answer to your question is you can do it. There are no regulatory restrictions. We will need to understand, for example, if you're acquiring an existing entity, whether there is any regulated activity that Indian entity undertakes, and therefore whether there needs to be some sort of restructuring at an Indian level. I hope that answers the question.
Yes, I'm not sure. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yes, I can now.
Okay. No, that thanks. That answers my question. Yes, of course, it was meant to ask about, like, corporate e-learning were just kind of certificates granted, but not in terms of degrees.
Absolutely. So that can be done very, very easily, Bettina. It's perfectly allowed under the foreign investment regulations.
Okay.
Thank you. Before we take the next question, we'd like to remind participants that you may press star and one to ask questions. We have the next question from the line of Monil Doshi. Please go ahead.
Hi, Vivek. Thank you for such a great conference. I wanted to ask you a question. What are the common diligence issues that you come across in education-focused deals?
Maybe I'll request Arushi to answer that question if she's still on the line. Arushi, do you want to take that?
Sure. So, Monil, thanks for your question. In fact, that's actually very interesting because we have seen a lot of activity that is happening in the education sector. I'll split the question into two parts and I'll answer accordingly. The first is in the regulated space where we talk about the K-12 and the higher education sector. Now, the way the sector is structured, like Vivek mentioned earlier, it's a not-for-profit sector as far as Indian regulatory regime is concerned, which means that the the structures are in the form of a trust or a society. And
when we do diligences, we read the charter documents, we try and see through the charter documents if there are any kind of restrictions in, you know, actually going ahead with the transaction. For example, if an entity is trying to take a loan, are there any restrictions? If the investor wants to come on board, are there any kind of restrictions? The second kind of check that we do is that are they complying with the laws? Again, like Vivek mentioned earlier, there are, you know, federal and state level laws. So, for instance, there is the Right to Education Act, there are Fee Regulation Acts, whether the entity complies with it or not. There are various affiliations from the UGC, from the AICT, and the other regulators that are to be sought in the higher education space. There are permission requirements for schools, etc. So we do a sanity check to highlight any kind of red flags. Now, as far as EdTech is concerned, like we discussed earlier, there are various laws that could apply depending on the kind of model that, you know, the EdTech player is going out in the market. So IP being the critical part, we do a check to see whether the ownership of the intellectual property actually rests with the EdTech entity. So, you know, sometimes in our experience, we have seen that EdTech players engage in, you know, software developers, service providers, etc. But the intellectual property assignments as per the local law requirements may not have happened. This kind of creates a red flag because you cannot transfer what you don't have. You can only give a title to what you rightfully have. So these are some of the things that we typically, you know, encounter from a diligence perspective.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else who wishes to ask a question may press star and one at this time. Participants who wish to ask questions may press star and one. We have the next question from the line of Roy Liu. Please go ahead.
Hi. Could any of you elaborate more about the complexity and if there's any additional reputational risk of the trust structure that we just mentioned for the nonprofit school? Thanks.
Sure. So Vivek here, let me see if I got your question correctly. You've asked on the potential reputational issues relating to the complexity of the trust structure. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Right. So I think it's you've asked an extremely pertinent and a very valid question. As I mentioned during the discussion, it has become obviously a pretty much standard structure in the country. And therefore, as you have to have a trust or a society or some form of not-for-profit entity, and then you have this services and management company structure, the fact that it's become pretty much standard across the sector is a positive sign from a perceptional and a reputational perspective. Where you need to be careful is it should not be seen that the trust, for example, does not maintain what we call a reasonable surplus of revenue, and all the revenue of the trust should not be extracted by way of service fees and management fees. There are decisions of the Supreme Court of India which have held that though it's a not-for-profit structure, there isn't really a bar on making a profit as long as you're not seen to be profiteering. Now, there is a very subtle distinction between making a profit and profiteering, but the way the courts have interpreted profiteering is making excessive profits and something that on the face of it is seen as extracting all the revenue out of the trust. So that's one thing that you need to keep in mind when you have the trust structure and when you have a services or a management company. You should be actually substantial services should be provided. It should not just be services on paper. That's another important aspect. The third aspect from a reputational perspective is that there are certain activities that a trust cannot outsource. And therefore, whether it's employment of the teachers, of the principal, and some of those very core functions, those really can't be outsourced to some sort of a management company or a services company. And therefore, you should be very clear when you're doing a transaction as to the services that are being provided. Are those services that can validly be outsourced by the trust? If you meet all these various requirements, then I don't see too much of a risk from a reputational perspective. But obviously, it's important to ensure that these various aspects are kept in mind throughout the life of this particular institution.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else who'd like to ask a question may press star and one. Well, as there are no further questions, I'd like to hand the conference back to Mr. Vivek Kathpalia for any closing comments.
Thank you so much. I think I hope we were of some use to all of you today. Let me thank you all for taking the time to join this webinar. If you have any questions, please feel free to send them to edtechwebinar.nda. There is an email ID which is available, and we'll have it sent to you. I would also like to thank all the speakers who have joined us from our offices on the West Coast as well as India. Thank you all for participating with us, and I wish you all a good day, a good night. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes this conference, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.